Welcome to Side B. 欢迎你来到 B 面。
Lesson 12. How long can people live? She took up skating at age 85, made her first movie appearance at age 114, and held a concert in the neighborhood on her 121st birthday. When it comes to long life, Jeanne Calment is the world's record holder. She lived to the ripe old age of 122. So, is 122 the upper limit to the human lifespan? If scientists come up with some sort of pill or diet that would slow aging, could we possibly make it to 150 or beyond? Researchers don't entirely agree on the answers. Calment lived to 122, so it wouldn't surprise me if someone alive today reaches 130 or 135, says Jerry Shea at the University of Texas. Steve Austad at the University of Texas agrees. People can live much longer than we think, he says. Experts used to say that humans couldn't live past 110. When Calment blew past that age, they raised the number to 120. So why can't we go higher? The trouble with guessing how old people can live to be is that it's all just guessing. Anyone can make up a number, says Rich Miller at the University of Michigan. Usually, the scientist who picks the highest number gets his name in Time magazine. Won't new anti-aging techniques keep us alive for centuries? Any cure, says Miller, for aging would probably keep most of us kicking until about 120. Researchers are working on treatments that lengthen the lifespan of mice by 50% at most. So, if the average human lifespan is about 80 years, says Miller, adding another 50% would get you to 120. So what can we conclude from this little disagreement among the researchers? That lifespan is flexible, but there is a limit, says George Martin of the University of Washington. We can get flies to live 50% longer, he says, but a fly is never going to live 150 years. Of course, if you became a new species, one that ages at a slower speed, that would be a different story, he adds. Does Martin really believe that humans could evolve their way to longer life? It's pretty cool to think about, he says with a smile.
Very good.
Lesson 13.
We are all interested in equality, but while some people try to protect the school and examination system in the name of equality, others, still in the name of equality, want only to destroy it. Any society which is interested in equality of opportunity and standards of achievement must regularly test its pupils. The standards may be changed. No examination is perfect. But to have no tests or examinations would mean the end of equality and of standards. There are groups of people who oppose this view and who do not believe either in examinations or in any controls in schools or on teachers. This would mean that everything would depend on luck, since every pupil would depend on the efficiency, the values, and the purpose of each teacher. Without examinations, employers will look for employees from the highly respected schools and from families known to them. A form of favoritism will replace equality. At the moment, the bright child from an ill-respected school can show certificates to prove he or she is suitable for a job, while the lack of certificate indicates the unsuitability of a dull child attending a well-respected school. This defense of excellence and opportunity would disappear if examinations were taken away, and the bright child from a poor family would be a prisoner of his or her school's reputation, unable to compete for employment with the child from the favored school. The opponents of the examination system suggest that examinations are an evil force because they show differences between pupils. According to these people, there must be no special, different academic class. They have even suggested that there should be no form of difference in sport or any other area. All jobs or posts should be filled by unsystematic selection. The selection would be made by people who themselves are probably selected by some computer.
Lesson 14. Sydney. As they sat sharing suites beside a swimming pool in 1999, Shane Gould and Jessica Shipper were simply getting along well, chatting about sport, life, and anything else that came up. Yet in Sydney next month, they will meet again by the pool, and for a short time, the friends will race against each other in the 50-meter butterfly in the Australian Championships at Homebush Bay. Gould, now a 47-year-old mother of four, has announced she will be making a return to elite competition to swim the one event, having set a qualifying time of 30.32 seconds in winning gold at last year's United States Masters Championships. Her comeback comes 32 years after she won three golds at the Munich Olympics. Shipper, now a 17-year-old from Brisbane with a bright future of going to Athens for her first Olympics, yesterday recalled her time with Gould 5 years ago. "I was at a national youth camp on the Gold Coast, and Shane had come along to talk to us and watch us train," Shipper explained. "It seemed as if we had long been good friends. I don't know why. We just started talking, and it went from there." She had a lot to share with all of us at that camp. She told us stories about what it was like at big meets like the Olympics, and what it's like to be on an Australian team. It was really interesting. "Next time, things will be more serious. I will still be swimming in the 50-meter butterfly at the Nationals, so there's a chance that I could actually be competing against Shane Gould," said Shipper, who burst onto the scene at last year's national championships with second places in the 100-meter and 200-meter butterfly. Lesson 15.
Art museums are places where people can learn about various cultures. The increasingly popular design museums that are opening today, however, perform quite a different role. Unlike most art museums, the design museum shows objects that are easily found by the general public. These museums sometimes even place things like fridges and washing machines in the center of the hall. People have argued that design museums are often made use of as advertisements for new industrial technology. But their role is not simply a matter of sales. It is the honoring of excellently invented products. The difference between the window of a department store and the showcase in a design museum is that the first tries to sell you something, while the second tells you the success of the sale. One advantage of design museums is that they are places where people feel familiar with the exhibits. Unlike the average art museum visitors, design museum visitors seldom feel frightened or puzzled. This is partly because design museums clearly show how and why mass-produced products work and look as they do, and how design has improved the quality of our lives. Art museum exhibits, on the other hand, would most probably fill visitors with a feeling that there is something beyond their understanding. In recent years, several new design museums have opened their doors. Each of these museums has tried to satisfy the public's growing interest in the field with new ideas. London's Design Museum, for example, shows a collection of mass-produced objects, from Zippo lighters to electric typewriters to a group of Italian fish tins. The choices open to design museums seem far less strict than those to art museums, and visitors may also sense the humorous part of our society while walking around such exhibits as interesting and unusually attractive toys collected in our everyday life.
Lesson 16. Millions of aircraft take off around the world every year. The skies they fly in seem limitless, miles of empty space. But, with the number of flights increasing each year, this emptiness no longer exists. Researchers in the world of aviation are worried about the increasing pressure on pilots and ground controllers, and increasing collisions occurring at or near an airport have called attention to the need for more aids to aviation control. People who travel the skies are not certain about air safety. A great deal of money is spent on new and bigger aircraft and airports to deal with the vast increase in passengers traveling by air. Only a small percentage of this money is spent on navigation and other aids. Actually, suitable electronic equipment has long existed, and many companies market safety aids designed to make it safer for aircraft to take off, fly any distance, and land, whatever the weather. Yet, there are two problems to be solved. The first is to get governments airlines and airport officials to agree to basic levels of safety aids. The second problem is to find a way of meeting these basic requirements. But no matter how well the equipment works, operators of the equipment still play an important role. Communications between pilots and ground controllers are extremely important to air safety. It is worth pointing out that the mishearing or misunderstanding of instructions in English and the use of another language in an international conversation have led to two recent aircraft accidents. A new type of instrument called Flight Watch would help pilots prevent airport collisions. It would be particularly helpful near airports. Lesson 17.
That cold January night, I was growing sick of my life in San Francisco. There I was, walking home at 1 a.m. after a tiring practice at the theater. With opening night only a week away, I was still learning my lines. I was having trouble dealing with my part-time job at the bank and my acting at night at the same time. As I walked, I thought seriously about giving up both acting and San Francisco. City life had become too much for me. As I walked down empty streets under tall buildings, I felt very small and cold. I began running, both to keep warm and to keep away from any possible robbers. Very few people were still out, except a few sad-looking homeless people under blankets. About a block from my apartment, I heard a sound behind me. I turned quickly, half expecting to see someone with a knife or a gun. The street was empty. All I saw was a shining street light. Still, the noise had made me nervous, so I started to run faster. Not until I reached my apartment building and unlocked the door did I realize what the noise had been. It had been my wallet falling to the sidewalk. Suddenly, I wasn't cold or tired anymore. I ran out of the door and back to where I'd heard the noise. Although I searched the sidewalk anxiously for 15 minutes, my wallet was nowhere to be found. Just as I was about to give up the search, I heard the garbage truck pull up to the sidewalk next to me, when a voice called from the inside, "Alisa Camacho?" I thought I was dreaming. How could this man know my name? The door opened, and out jumped a small red-haired man with an amused look in his eye. "Is this what you're looking for?" he asked, holding up a small square shape. It was nearly 3 a.m. by the time I got into bed. I wouldn't get much sleep that night, but I had gotten my wallet back. I also had gotten back some enjoyment of city life. I realized that the city couldn't be a bad place as long as people were willing to help each other.
Very good.
Lesson 18. These days, a green building means more than just the color of the paint. Green building can also refer to environmentally friendly houses, factories, and offices. Green building means reducing the impact of the building on the land, Taryn Halauka of the U.S. Green Building Council in Washington, D.C. said. According to Halauka, buildings account for 65% of total U.S. electricity use. But green buildings can reduce energy and water use. Also, the buildings are often located near public transportation, such as buses and subways, so that people can drive their cars less. That could be good for the environment, because cars use lots of gas and give off pollution. Green buildings are often built on developed land, so that the buildings don't destroy forests. Marty Dealing is project manager for a building that put these ideas into action. The Solaire has been called the country's first green high-rise building. According to Dealing, we've reduced our energy use by one-third and our water by 50%. The Solaire cuts energy in part by using solar power. On the face of the building, we have solar panels, which change the sun's energy into electricity, Dealing explained. The Solaire also has lights that automatically turn off when people leave the room. In addition, the building has lots of windows, allowing people to use the sun for light during the day. The Solaire cuts water waste by reusing it. Not everyone is eager to move into a green building, however. Some people think that things like solar panels cost more money than more traditional energy sources. Anyhow, Halauka said, it's going to be big. Lesson 19.
We live in a technological society where most goods are mass-produced by unskilled labor. Because of this, most people think that craft no longer exists. One of the ways these people wrongly support their view is by pointing to 100-year-old homes, which are still solid, and arguing that it is the craftsmanship that is responsible for their durability. Homes in those days were well built, they say. No doubt these homes were well built, but what these people have done is mix up the quality of material used in the house with the quality of the craftsmanship. Homes today could be built to last just as long as those old homes if people were willing or able to pay the price. For example, most people can no longer afford solid oak stairways, although they were once fairly common in older homes. Nor can they afford the high labor cost of employing a carpenter to build the stairway. Yet if someone can pay the high cost, there are still plenty of carpenters around able to make those stairways. And not only would these carpenters know how to build them, they would probably do a better job than carpenters of old. One thing the modern carpenter has which enables him to do a better job is much more advanced tools. Such tools as laser beams and power planes help them lay out a house better and make more precision cuts on the wood. Also, it is not uncommon anymore to find carpenters with college degrees and carpenters with a solid knowledge of mathematics, which would enable them to deal with more difficult house designs. The problem of modern quality, then, really boils down to the problem of material, for the modern carpenter is just as able to produce craftsmanship as the carpenter of 50 years ago, but only if given proper material.
You have proven yourself audacious, courageous, and distinctive, one of a kind.
Lesson 20. It was an early September day, cool and bright and just right for running, and I was in the first few miles of a 10-mile race, over a course with a few high hills. Still, I felt energetic. Despite the hills, it was going to be a fine run. Just ahead of me was Peggy Nimno, a teacher from Mount Kisco, New York. She, too, was running easily, moving along at my speed. The pace felt comfortable, so I decided to stay where I was. Why pay attention to pace when she was setting such a nice one? I'd overtake her later on when she tired. So I ran behind her. The course headed north for 5 miles, wandered west for a hilly mile, then turned south again along a winding road. The race was getting harder. We had 4 miles left, and already it was beginning to be real work. Peggy overtook a young runner. She seemed to know him, for they exchanged a few cheerful words as she passed him. Their exchange worried me. You don't chat during a race unless you are feeling good, and Peggy plainly was. Still, I was close enough to overtake her if she tired, so I didn't give up hope completely. We were getting nearer to a long, punishing hill now, and it would be the test. We were a mile from the finish line, so whatever happened on the hill would almost certainly determine who crossed it first. As I moved up the hill, my attention wandered for a few minutes. When I looked up, Peggy was moving away. First 5 yards, then 10, then more. Finally, it was clear that there was no hope of catching her. She beat me soundly. There is an important lesson in that race. Women are thought to be weaker, slower, and not nearly as skilled in sport. Yet, as Peggy Nimno so clearly showed, the similarities between men and women runners are more important than the differences. I have run with a number of women, and I can say that it is often hard work.
Very good.
Lesson 21.
He was the baby with no name, found and taken from the North Atlantic 6 days after the sinking of the Titanic in 1912. His tiny body so moved the salvage workers that they called him our baby. In their home port of Halifax, Nova Scotia, people collected money for a headstone in front of the baby's grave, carved with the words, "To the memory of an unknown child. He has rested there ever since." But history has a way of uncovering its secrets. On November 5th this year, members of a family from Finland arrived at Halifax and laid fresh flowers at the grave. "This is our baby," says Magda Schleifer, 68, a banker. She grew up hearing stories about a great aunt named Maria Panula, 42, who had sailed on the Titanic for America to be reunited with her husband. According to the information Mrs. Schleifer had gathered, Panola gave up her seat on a lifeboat to search for her five children, including a 13-month-old boy named Aino, from whom she had become separated during the final minutes of the crossing. "We thought they were all lost in the sea," says Schleifer. Now, using teeth and bone pieces taken from the baby's grave, scientists have compared the DNA from the unknown child with those collected from members of five families who lost relatives on the Titanic and never recovered the bodies. The result of the test points only to one possible person, young Aino. Now, the family sees no need for a new grave. "He belongs to the people of Halifax," says Schleifer. "They've taken care of him for 90 years. Adapted from People, November 25th, 2002.
Lesson 22. Every year, more people recognize that it is wrong to kill wildlife for sport. Progress in this direction is slow because shooting is not a sport for watching, and only those few who take part realize the cruelty and destruction. The number of gunners, however, grows rapidly. Children too young to develop proper judgments through independent thought are led a long way away by their gunning parents. They are subjected to advertisements of gun producers who describe shooting as good for their health and gun carrying as a way of putting redder blood in the veins. They are persuaded by gunner magazines with stories honoring the chase and the kill. In school, they view motion pictures, which are supposedly meant to teach them how to deal with arms safely, but which are actually designed to stimulate a desire to own a gun. Wildlife is disappearing because of shooting and because of the loss of wildland habitat. Habitat loss will continue with our increasing population, but can we slow the loss of wildlife caused by shooting? There doesn't seem to be any chance if the serious condition of our birds is not improved. Wildlife belongs to everyone, and not to the gunners alone. Although most people do not shoot, they seem to forgive shooting for sport because they know little or nothing about it. The only answer, then, is to bring the truth about sport shooting to the great majority of people. Now it is time to realize that animals have the same right to life as we do, and that there is nothing fair or right about a person with a gun shooting the harmless and beautiful creatures. The gunners like to describe what they do as character building, but we know that to wound an animal and watch it go through the agony of dying can make nobody happy. If, as they would have you believe, gun carrying and killing improve human character, then perhaps we should encourage war. Lesson 23.
Deserts are found where there is little rainfall or where rain for a whole year falls in only a few weeks' time. 10 inches of rain may be enough for many plants to survive if the rain is spread throughout the year. If it falls within 1 or 2 months and the rest of the year is dry, those plants may die and a desert may form. Sand begins as tiny pieces of rock that get smaller and smaller as wind and weather wear them down. Sand dunes are formed as winds move the sand across the desert. Bit by bit, the dunes grow over the years, always moving with the winds and changing the shape. Most of them are only a few feet tall, but they can grow to be several hundred feet high. There is, however, much more to a desert than sand. In the deserts of the southwestern United States, cliffs and deep valleys were formed from thick mud that once lay beneath the sea more than millions of years ago. Over the centuries, the water dried up. Wind, sand, rain, heat, and cold all wear away at the remaining rocks. The faces of the desert mountains are always changing, very, very slowly, as these forces of nature continue to work on the rock. Most deserts have a surprising variety of life. There are plants, animals, and insects that have adapted to life in the desert. During the heat of the day, a visitor may see very few signs of living things. But as the air begins to cool in the evening, the desert comes to life. As the sun begins to rise again in the sky, the desert once again becomes quiet and lonely.
This is the end of Tape 1. Please join us for Tape 2.